everyone, it's Erin with Tall Ships America, and you are listening to A Bark, A Brig, and A Schooner Walk Into A Bar, a podcast where I get to know the people in our tall ship community. If you've been enjoying these episodes, please subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts. Also, consider becoming a member or donating to Tall Ships America so I can keep talking to tater tot loving sailors. Help us support the tall ships at tallshipsamerica.org. This week's guest is Hallie Boyd, director of the Seafarer Collective, a program with Grace Harbor Historical Seaport. She's also the founder of CB Consulting, a marketing, brand narrative, and business development company. For any tall ships that are interested in working with Hallie, I will put her website in the show notes. During our discussion, I learned that Hallie is a fellow anthropology major with a background in training horses. We agree that river pilots are pretty cool and that schooners are majorly crush-worthy. We end up talking about the importance of giving people choices and her work promoting diversity in the maritime workforce.
Take it away. We're off to the races.
Okay. All right. So thank you so much, Hallie, for being here. I really appreciate the time that you are taking out of your very busy day running the West Coast. I can just have you say your name, position, and organization, please.
Oh, I love this. My name is Hallie Boyd. I'm a Scorpio. I like long walks on the beach. My name is Hallie Boyd. I am the director of the Seafarer Collective, which is a workforce development program of Grays Harbor Historical Seaport.
So can you kind of elaborate on the Seafarer Collective, what that means exactly?
Oh, man. Yeah, sure. I think that's a great question right off the bat, Erin. What is the Seafarer Collective? So in its current iteration, we've been defining it as a social justice program that comes through the function of a maritime resource hub. So what does that mean? Everybody's like, I don't know what that means.
it sounds really good though.
Yeah. And just end of conversation. That's just what it is. If you don't know, then you don't know. We just have multiple branches. And so it was really apparent when we started this program that there were a variety of needs for our students and for the crews that were on the boats. And so what it's kind of winnowed down to is online education in the form of coursework and education focused on entry-level mariners, and we can talk more about what that means for folks because it's a little bit different. So online education, both just in sort of job training and also in career preparedness, and sometimes, and this is I'm sure going to be the thing that everyone's going to be like, it's credentialing or it's licensing, but we're working on getting folks merchant mariner credentials. So whether it's an OS entry level, just your first MMC, or something like an able seaman domestic. So we do online education. Depending on the phase of the year, we'll do financial aid that will be providing funding for further education for folks. Even if they're not in one of our online classes, we have crew development grants for qualified mariners that have served on a Grays Harbor vessel at any time. They can apply for a crew development grant. And then we do mentorship connections, so getting hopeful mariners connected with folks in the industry, that's very informal at this point. So we do, it's like, hey, I know someone on that boat. you want to work on that boat? Why don't you two chat? we also do a fair amount of community outreach, which has changed in the last 3 months as it has for everybody. So historically, I would have a pretty beefy chunk of the summer where I'd be going to conferences, festivals, schools, trade organizations, basically anybody who will hand me a microphone or give me a table to hang out at, I'll go and talk about the maritime industry. We've done a little bit of education crafted for specific events, depending on the target demographic. So, a younger group, we might do an introduction to working on the water. With like a trade organization, we might go in and do like a brown bag lunch where we're kind of like doing real talk on the job. So we do all those. And then it's all sort of under this overarching umbrella of trying to change the face of the maritime industry in bringing underserved and underrepresented mariners into the commercial space by way of traditional vessels. So getting folks on traditional boats so that they can actually qualify for sea time to get on commercial vessels, because at the end of the day, we wanted them to have careers that could make them money, to put it plainly. So that's the beef of it. And it's, at this point, I mean, even leading up to COVID-19, because right now at the time that we're talking, it's what day is it? August. 30th or something. No, it's August 5th.
Time has no meaning. It's fine.
Yeah. Sometime in August. But prior to that, we had migrated to online. So our team is very much all over. So I've got my lead instructors in Maine. Pre-COVID, my assistant director was in Columbus. I have a gentleman named Richard, who I think you've met before, Aaron, that is in Spokane. I'm in Portland, Oregon. And so, and our students are all over the country as well. So it sort of plays into that idea of that network.
So, I mean, you bring up COVID-19, so how, and I was actually going to ask this a little bit later, but since it came up, so how has it really affected the industry? You know, here we are looking at workforce development, and that's something that Tallships America Chris is our executive director, is very passionate about right now, is workforce development, because the maritime mm-hmm. industry is aging out. There are a lot of opportunities here, but it's not an area that if you don't live on the coast, I guess you're really not aware of it, or you maybe think there's more to it than there actually is. And I think I'm fairly certain I'm oversimplifying. But so right now during COVID, of course, none of our ships or a lot of the industry is at the dock. So have you talked to crew? How are they dealing with this? And how can they come back from this stronger?
Yeah. So there's a couple different conversations that are happening amongst the community that I'm working with. Because the majority of my folks are interested in a commercial profession, or I'm hopeful that they're interested in pursuing that, but sometimes they get on a tall ship and then they just fall in love, kind of like we all do. And and they want to stay.
And secretly you're really happy.
Yeah. I love the fact that there are folks with a professional mind that are entering the industry with it as a career as the goal. And if they do spend more time in the tall ship industry, great. We're all going to be better for it. But the conversations with them is a little bit different because the commercial side of things is booming. Like, I haven't seen a reduction in, booming is a really strong word. I have not seen a reduction in the workload or work frequency of folks in my community that are working on the commercial side. If anything, I've been seeing an uptick. Mm-hmm. So there have been some more, I think, stringent regulations around times of quarantine, kind of the types of contracts that are being done, but we're still seeing folks hiring and looking for work and, you know, an exchange going on. As far as tall ships, I've had to have some really frank conversations with my community and saying this entire situation with COVID was very telling. It's very telling whether we're looking at tall ships or benchmarking it against other nonprofits, very telling of the stability and the vulnerability of this space. Because what we saw and what we're still seeing is a complete reduction. And even our program was hugely impacted by that, because even though the Seafarer Collective is an online program, it can only operate with the way that the funding functions if Gray's Harbor is functioning. And so with Gray's Harbor at reduced hours and reduced operations, just like everybody else, the Seafarer Collective has to follow in tandem. So we're trying to find ways to create continued opportunities, but we've been getting an uptick in interest for education because folks are, I think you're seeing this not in just in the maritime industry, but in all industries, people are like, maybe I need to go back to school. Maybe it's mm-hmm. time to tune up my resume a little bit. Like mm-hmm. things are about to get a lot more competitive. Mm-hmm. And so we're getting a lot more inquiries for this, but then the question is, can we give them a reliable or dependable offer at the end of that? And right now the answer is no.
Right.
What I can tell them is, this is a great opportunity to take care of, you know, credentialing, licensing, any sort of things that you've been meaning to do, to begin the process of familiarizing yourself with what it is to be engaging with the National Maritime Center. And all those things are skills that have to be honed. But I've taken out any sort of onboard portion in the programming, which is usually it's kind of a modular situation where I'm like, we could do an online portion, then an onboard portion, then maybe a job placement. You know, we kind of piecemeal it depending on the student. And now I'm like, we can offer you the online and the education, but I would strongly encourage you to be focusing your eye on the horizon of commercial jobs versus traditional at this point, because I haven't seen any evidence that would leave me to believe that this is going to be something resolved in the next working season. So if we're able to get boats back out in programming, the capacity is reduced. If we're able to get people out and running, then there's a health risk. You know, there's all these mm-hmm. different boxes that have to be checked for this, that if I was just like, if I had no emotional attachment to the vessels, I would say, don't even think about it. Don't even look at it. They're not going to be around. But because of my history with all of the other vessels in the community, that hits a little bit of like a, you know, a little bit of a pang for me, because I don't want to make that statement to students and be like, ride off the tall ships. But if I'm trying to take a professional coaching standpoint, I'm like, let's look at who has the most diverse portfolio, essentially, in terms of their assets or their programming. And because I think so many tall ships are so specific, it's so niche in what they can do in terms of geography and sort of the physicality of things and proximity, it's a really challenging sort of business to be in at this point.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, it's challenging anyway. Every year is a challenging year, but...
Yeah, it's always a hustle. It's always a grind.
You know?
And that's like, it's one of the most interesting things that I find in interacting with tall ships and organizations and vessels and mariners, is the expectations for organizational health are much lower in, I think, oftentimes the nonprofit space. And I really, like, if there was one thing I would advocate for is in opposition to that. It's, you know, the conversation where it's just like, we just have to grind through this last little bit. We've just got to get over the hump. Everything's going to get better. But if that narrative continues to be, or doesn't even continue, it's just is the standard, is the norm. And the expectation is that you do this for like the good of your heart and like the passion that you have. And this is not, again, this is not unique to tall ships. This is, if you've worked in other nonprofits, I know everybody has seen and heard this and been a part of that. It's just like, we're just doing this. We're going to just try and will it into success.
Right.
It becomes really challenging, I think. And I think it becomes really taxing emotionally and energetically and efficiency wise. Like, you see things reduced, and I think clarity of mission and vision are really difficult to hone in on right now, because so many folks are trying to, I think, do small pivots to land on something that's going to be the thing that's going to save them. And without that really clear why and really clear identity, I think we're in for a really challenging time for, you know, the coming months and years.
Yeah, I think so too. But it sounds, you obviously have so much passion for it. So how did you get involved in tall ships? Where are you from? What was your first ship? Why tall ships?
Why tall ships? Let's see. Okay. So I did not come from a maritime background at all. To this day, I don't think that either of my parents have ever stepped on board a boat, save for like, I think my mom picked me up on Tullymore for like lunch one time, but yelled at me from the dock and was like, get the hell down. So definitely that's not like the background that I came from. I grew up training horses, and I did that for, a while. I ended up leaving high school when I was 15 to do it full time, and was riding horses and training horses and doing horse grooming. And that was sort of my entire world for a really long time. And then I ended up traveling for a long time and going to school. And I went to school for, again, nothing related to anything in our industry, and ended up getting recruited right out of college to do coaching for success coaching for kids on probation. And so it was a really wonderful opportunity to kind of learn how to kind of unpack the obstacles that people were engaging with, how to get them towards success, trying to figure out what it looked like for people to be able to live their lives and function the way that they wanted to do it. But it was very much like a corporate job. Like, I had graduated from Berkeley. The next week I was working in San Francisco, like in a suit in an office, like doing that. And so that was my life for like many years.
Oh, really? And so, but did you have any background in coaching kids like that? Or was that something that you had pulled from your horse training background? And was that something, cause I know that they do a lot of like therapy with horses and stuff. So is that something that, is that how that came about?
Yeah. I had done some different kinds of education with horses, but none of it was equestrian therapy based. So my degree was in cultural anthropology, but I was focusing.
I was an anthropology major. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great one. It's a nice, like, nice tasting platter, you know?
It is.
It's great. And I ended up writing a thesis where I lived with the Berkeley Fire Department for, not full time, but worked on and off with them for a year. Doing a linguistic study on them to try and find ways of identifying critical incident stress within their communities, and trying to determine by recording and tracking and sort of documenting their stories when they were showing markers of stress and how their stress was modified by the physical locations that they were in. So if they were in a private residence or in their own firehouse or in their private bedroom or at a social event or in a grocery store, how their communication patterns would shift, and trying to basically write a piece of advocacy for mandatory decompression to avoid transference of trauma in the field. And so a lot of what I was doing at that time was looking at storytelling and linguistic patterns, and a lot of it was just asking questions and sort of seeing what it was that people were really needing in that space to release from what it is to be operating as an emergency medical worker. It was really a lot of exchange within their own communities that was doing a lot of the not transference. They were receiving transference, but they were going through decompression one-on-one as a way of coping with the trauma. Right. And so I had come from that sort of mind space of really people will tell you what they need and people will tell you what they want, even in just general conversation. And so it applied well to that job. And so I ended up jumping into that and I really enjoyed it. And it was almost all of my clients were over the phone. So I ended up just spending most of my time talking and non-traditional students. So people that were, you know, 17 to 65 that were still just trying to figure out what it was to go through education. And so, you know, that job was totally like a gut punch in terms of what I wanted to do, but I've leaned so hard on those skills mm-hmm. later in life. I'm like so grateful, mm-hmm. but so I was doing that job and I ended up meeting, I was at a party because
the days, all good stories should start. I was at a party.
I was at a party. The days were long and hard and I was at a party. And I remember this just epic creature, drove up to this party on this motorcycle. And, she had this like smoke bomb that had been going off the back of this motorcycle. And she stepped off and she was like all dressed in leather and like took her helmet off and had this like side of her head shaved, and she was just like this glowing just magician of awesome. And I was like, oh my God, look at this broad. I love it. I'm just going to marry her. And she came in the party and we ended up hitting it off. And I was like, that was a solid entrance. I really appreciate that. And she was like, and we ended up talking and she found out that I'd had a background in horses. And she, for some reason, you know, whether it was like the party or just the actual relationship, she's like, you do great on boats. It's exactly the same. And I was like, yeah, just like antiquated, slow forms of transportation, like a lot of line. I'm not, you know, and she's like, totally, you do well with it. And I was also doing personal training on the side. So she was like, you'd be great. You could lift a bunch of stuff. It'd be perfect. And then she's like, I'll be down in Los Angeles. I'm doing a contract down there. So if you're ever down there, swing on by. And I had grown up in LA, but was living in Portland at the time. And so it was one of those like invites at a party where people are like, oh my God, we should hang out. And you don't actually do it. But I was like, I was ready. So I packed up a backpack and ended up, I can't remember how I got down there. I think I like caught a ride. And she was working on the Lamy boats down in San Pedro. And so I got there in like the middle of the night and I like called her and was like, hey, remember me when we met at that party and you said I should swing by? Like, I'm here. she was so confused. She was like, okay. Cool. It's like, surprise. It's me.
That's not weird at all. That's normal.
So I just stayed. Uh-huh. I stayed for a couple days and then realized that she was going from the Lamy boats over to the Grace Harbor boats. She was going to like doing a little bit of a switch because it was at the time they were doing these kind of winter periods where the Lamy boats and the Grace Harbor boats would all kind of be in that same area and they'd be doing a bunch of work. And everybody was like, oh, it's like tall ship summer camp down there, but in the winter and, you know, with less activities of a structured nature. And so I ended up hanging out and the captain was like, oh, you could just hang out for a couple of days. And it's one of those things where then like days became more days and weeks became more weeks kind of thing. And so I called my friends up in Portland and I was like, I'll pay you $200 if you move all my stuff into storage. I'll be back, I think, in maybe a couple of weeks. And then I just stayed. I ended up sailing back up. Like I just stayed on the boat for like, I think, we were on for maybe 9 months, maybe, I don't know, maybe shorter than that. So we ended up I just ended up sailing all the way back to Astoria, to Oregon, and got off the boat there. And I was like, oh, shoot. So, and that was like on Lady Washington and the crew was great. And I think, you know, bless their hearts, Grace Harbor actually had no idea that I even existed until I think we got to the Columbia and they like saw a crew manifest and they were like, who's Hallie Boyd? And the captain was like, she's been on the boat since winter. They were like, we have no record of her. We have no idea. Like, I hadn't told anybody in the office. Like, I am the nightmare student. So I was just like, oh, was I supposed to,
tell someone, I guess.
Yeah. So like, do as I say, not as I do. So I did that. And then, that whole crew ended up sort of just clumping and decided we were going to get a house together in Portland and start this like boat commune. And so we started this place called the Boat House that had a bunch of mariners and we had a bunch of storage, and we were like, all right, this is going to be our sort of transition space for on and off boat. Like, we're just going to run it like a ship and people can come and it's just going to be glorious. And, and there's a bunch of us. And so, you know, what could go wrong? just like throw a bunch of sailors in a house together that have lost all sense of purpose because they're not on a boat anymore. And so many of us very quickly realized we needed to go back and work on boats. And so I left all my stuff there again. Poor Portland is just like a constant closet. And then started doing, I think, the next phase, which is the East Coast, West Coast, like hop along. Do you want me to keep going on that?
Yeah, you can keep going on that. Well, who any knows? Ships like that you, that really stand out for you? Because I was creeping around Facebook, I saw that you had worked in Unicorn, and I had my Sisters Under Sail shirt on yesterday. And Tully Moore, RIP. Actually, RIP, both Unicorn and Tully Moore. That's kind of
there
any other ships that kind of stand out for you? Want to talk about your experience on Unicorn? Actually, you're the first person I think I've interviewed that actually sailed in Unicorn.
Yeah, that crew was insane in the best way possible. That was an amazing contract. So that was a contract in 2013 doing the Tall Ships America season in the lakes.
So were you in the lakes?
Yeah. So I was in the lakes. I know. I remember you, Erin. Fine. So I did that season. We ended up getting on Unicorn in Connecticut, in Bridgeport, and it was the year after Sandy. And so the boat had been left pretty quickly, in quick fashion. And so we showed up, and none of the crew at that point that had shown up had ever worked on the boat. They'd never sailed the boat. The boat was undercover in like this weird sort of miniature sort of village of nightmares and like summertime, you know, it's like all the little shacks down in like the little boardwalk are really small, but it was winter and it was abandoned. And you're like, this is terrifying. This is where I die. Like, this is awful. And so I got there and it was like Emma Millett at the time, now Emma Hathaway, Danny Doggett, who runs the Project Seba down in Costa Rica, who's just phenomenal. We had like Mariah, who now is like out on big commercial gigs. There was Becca Rusk. I had somehow managed to wrangle a cook, Martha, who had never sailed before from Portland, but was an amazing cook. We had this Canadian, Caitlin Simpson, who was just like the most phenomenal engineer and the best storyteller. It was just such a cool roster of really interesting, qualified women. And we had some Canadians in the mix, which was awesome because their credentialing and licensing was just so much beefier. And so we ended up doing that season. And it was huge, just the camaraderie. Like, some of those folks to this day have ended up being my best friends on that season. And I know it's like everybody has those boats that are that the crews just like kind of never left each other's hearts, but that season was good. And then I ended up going just straight onto Virginia with Emma. And so that boat in itself is just so sexy. Like,
she is. Yeah. Whew, yeah. You know, especially like, coming from Unicorn, who's like the cutest little tub. She really is. But she's also a ship. I remember Bert saying how much he would absolutely love to get his hands on Unicorn. He just thought she was just like the sweetest little ship, just indestructible. I mean, she had a U-boat hull. Was that what it was?
She had a riveted steel hull.
She was so a little tank.
That boat was dreadful to sail. I'm going to say that right now. I'm going to say it. And sailing is a generous description of of what ended up happening. Like, it was, you know, it was one of those things where you just really felt like you were being gaslighted by the ship, because the forecastle was sort of like an MC Escher situation. Like, all of the crew was up forward, and it was this, you know, it's sort of this fanned out, like, you know, the bunks, you would kind of climb on top of the bunks to get up. And it, but the boat, it's just like you would get thrown out of your bunk and just be like, oh my God, we're all gonna die. And you'd come up and it would be glassy, like just glassy. And I'm like, what is happening down there? Like, just hogging all over. It was just disastrous. And, but it was such an oddly appointed boat. Like, you'd be walking down below decks and there's just like a, you know, an underlit wet bar. But then if you were working in the rig, you were like, did they steal all the parts for the wet bar? Like, there was this awful photo series that I wish now I could have a hand on, because it was just the perfect description. So that crew was, I think, hired for a variety of reasons. But one of the reasons that we were hired was the owner really wanted us to have college degrees and be able to be inspiring leaders for young females that were coming out, because we were doing leadership and empowerment training, which was some of the best, I think, and most interesting programming for me in terms of what we were actually doing. Like, that programming itself just hit all of my buttons.
Right.
I just loved it.
Right.
But the expectation was that we would be, you know, in pink polos, for Lord's sake, have a headband on and look, you know, composed and be ready to like perform in many ways, so that when press would come or when we'd be interacting with public, there was no way that there could be any sort of like weakness identified in that public persona. But so there's this, I can't remember, it wasn't like Miramichi, it was like some Canadian port, I can't remember, or maybe it was in Toronto or something, but at some point during a transit, like one of the collars had been slipping that had one of the yard collars, and I was working as bosun, like with Becca Rusk, and so we were up in the rigging and we were like getting ready for tours, and so both of us are in these like cute little pink polos. I think I had like braided pigtails and I'm like, you know, done up, and I'm up there, but I have like a spud wrench, and someone in an apartment building was like taking these like telephoto like images of us, like zoomed in. And so there's this whole series that looks like it's from some like crime drama where I'm obviously yelling something inappropriate, but it's like this whole sequence where like you see the wrench and I'm like, mother like just like so foul and angry. But if you like leafed through the photos, it was like one of those flip books where, and then you just see me and Becca both like, just like hands up in the air, and they like sent this to the boat and they were like, look at these cute pictures, I thought you might want to see them. And I was like, okay, well, maybe let's keep those pictures private, shall we? So that boat was great. But yeah, then you go to Virginia, mm-hmm. and like such a boat crush, like yeah. that boat
yeah.
in itself was phenomenal. And it was like one of those weird seasons. Like, I feel like I've just been kind of like the queen of weird seasons, like where she was coming out of like a bit of a retirement to do the New York Yacht Club Regatta that kind of ended up salvaging a season. And it was one of those times where like Virginia had been going in and out and they were at Nauticus, and then it was like, oh great, we got the season. And so I'd been brought in as kind of like a late addition, and loved that boat and loved that crew and learned a ton from Hank Mosley. Mm-hmm. He has consistently been one of the folks that has been, I think, the most generous and also the most challenging in terms of the learning, because he had really high expectations. And at that point I didn't really know what that looked like, but that really helped because it prepared me. Cause then I ended up going from there, I don't even know where, back to Tullymore, you know, like I don't like to be cold. So I'm happy about jumping around. And like that boat is just such a funky, like Steve Zissou situation. And like, again, a weird season. It was like the last maintenance season before they sold her to Barefoot Cruises. So it was like a month and a half in a yard in the air down in Encinitas where it got real weird and like a little Lord of the Flies, like got a little depressing. And then ended up going out to the Windjammers in Maine.
Yeah.
And like that, so like that fleet and those boats and that season, like if I were to make any recommendation to any mariner that's starting out, I would first thing I'd be like, get on a Windjammer.
Yeah.
Just do a season. Like do a season, do two seasons. Your ability to actually get hands on gear, get a handle on what it is to actually be sailing, because so much of that fleet is, you know, operating without, without the desail, you know, they're just actually sailing, and the small boat work that you're doing is huge,
huge.
And it was that, like, if I were to pick one boat and one contract that I think, really, I think gave me the most tools for my tool belt in terms of like what I was able to take away from it, was that season I was on the Merry Day. And I remember when I was like interviewing for the job, they were like, can you row? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, can you row though? Like row. And I was like, yeah, I don't understand what you're asking me. Like, are we talking about rowing? Like, what are we talking about? But it was, what I realized now is like, they were like, this is your primary form of transportation, because you have these little pea pods on there. And you know, if you're coming up alongside, it's for profit. You know, this is like,
This is the
newlyweds and the nearly deads, as they say. So it's like, you've got retirees and like people that are on their honeymoon, and you are hustling and grinding. You're sailing nonstop. Like there's no rest, and you are taking them on shore. You know, you're taking them on shore, but you're rowing them to shore in like little 4-person pea pods. And you're like, okay, like this is good.
I'm rowing. This is rowing.
rowing. And then, so just like your ability to get hands on that kind of gear, the quality of like the prep, and I don't know, I can't speak to like the rest of the fleet, but for Merry Day, getting a boat ready, like the level of finish was much higher, like in terms, like, you know, there was just like yacht finish on a lot of this stuff. And then the yawl boats that you use, like the actual push boats that you're using to maneuver in and out, so helpful. Like I'll talk to tall ship sailors that work, I think, in the more, like in the more general education fleet. And like, they're like, I've never even sat in a small boat. Like, and that's the kind of stuff that I think becomes really handy, especially when you then transition into commercial. Because if you've, the more boats you've handled, the more types of sailing you've done, I don't care if it's like you sticking it on a paint float, or you know, like running around in a little tiny sailboat, or you rowing, or you know, it's like all of those are going to add to your repertoire. So I think that season was really good in terms of traditional skills.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what a lot of people don't realize, and you kind of alluded to this when you were talking about the Merry Day and the Windjammers, is that these are traditional rigged vessels. These are tall ships, and some of them are rather quite large, that don't have an engine. So they have to, they're maneuvering, or they're sailing around Penobscot Bay, the coast of Maine, using these smaller yawl boats as their engine. So to say that you honed your skills, I do think that's an understatement. And I have so much respect for the captains and crew who work on board those ships, because it can get pretty hairy out there. I mean, this isn't like, you know, gentle sailing. This is Maine in the summer. This is, you know, you're sailing, you have guests on board who aren't that familiar with being on board a tall ship. And here you are doing all of this in rather close quarters on and off the dock without using an engine. So it's, I think you get really good at customer service and you get really good at your ship handling skills.
I mean, there's a ton to be said for, I think for sailing schooners. Like I love a schooner. Like I just love it. I love it from a personal perspective, but I love it from a business perspective. So, and that's something that like, as I moved forward, it was really trying to like stop and look and say, okay, what are the organizations doing? What are the owners doing? And being able to be within the Windjammers and see what it was to be both a small business owner and an operator, I think was really illuminating, because whether it was direct or just by observation, I was able to learn a lot about what it is to carve out a space within this sort of world that we occupy,
right?
And for something to be sustainable, because so much of what I was seeing then and what I still see now is there is this kind of seasoning process that you need as someone who's participating, just to kind of not be fumbling around. And then the second you get good, you're like, I can't live here anymore. I can't do this anymore. And so you leave and go on to other pastures oftentimes, which is a real issue in terms of the quality of work. And I think the professionalism that's able to be maintained. And so seeing small business owners that were also sailing as their job was really interesting to see, and kind of what they were unwilling to compromise on in terms of quality and performance and delivery. And it was more polished than I see from a lot of other tall ship communities, which I think sometimes people are surprised by, because they're like, oh, it's this just kind of this tiny fleet that not everybody really engages with. And it ends up just being very cool. Like, you get to see folks that have been sailing the same boats in the same areas for a really long time. But with that comes, I think, a mastery of that particular craft. And it is Absolutely. Difficult to like compare, right? Because you're like, they're the best at this specific thing. And you can take some of that and it won't necessarily apply directly, but you can bring the same rules of engagement, the same expectations for quality, like their ability to, you know, bring a boat in and drift it in within like 2 inches of a buoy and be like, yeah, if you could just go ahead and hook that without any stress, there's no right. yelling, there's no, right, and understanding right, right. like the dynamics of like pushing and pulling with small boats was immensely helpful when I moved to the commercial industry and started working on tugboats, because that, whole different ballgame. Like none of what I'd, it was like starting over when I moved to commercial for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So when did you move to commercial and how long did you do that for?
So after Maine, I ended up getting my captain's license while I was up there. There's like a little shop that's run really well, down East Maritime. And, you know, so I was able to go there and work on getting my AB and my 100 ton, you know, sort of just like your regular tall ship baggage. And I was like, okay, I need to start making some money and I need to find something that will allow me to actually have time off. So looking at what I had been doing for the years leading up to that, it was like always on, you know, you're just like, mm-hmm. you're in a winter maintenance, you're in a season, you mm-hmm. might have a week, you know, there was no balance to that. And so right.
you're always hustling.
Yeah. And like, it's enjoyable and it's like you're hanging out with all of your favorite people, having interesting conversations, seeing interesting places, but how long can you do that for? You know, history would tell us about 5 to 7 years, maybe, you know, if we look at like the majority of fleet. So I was like, all right, I'm going to go commercial. And I had heard rumors about this company up in Portland, Oregon, that was producing the highest number of Columbia River pilots at the time. In terms of just like the most river pilots had come from this company. And so I was like, I'm going to go work for them. And this was a really interesting dynamic. I'd seen a lot of folks that had started within the Grays Harbor sailing community that had gone commercial. And I think it was a combination of sort of the geography, being close to Puget Sound, being close to the river systems, sort of isolated from the rest of the traditional fleet. I sometimes feel like Grays Harbor sailors don't engage at the same level when they like they're not necessarily going back and forth different boats, and that's changed now, but at the right. time it was I think much more isolated mm-hmm. and so people would go to commercial and they would get into Alaska or Hawaii or uncruise is a really popular destination for a lot of sailors, which is great because bigger tonnage, you know, different kinds of contracts, stuff like that. So I really wanted to work for this company. I came out here with my then boyfriend who I'd picked up along the way, who is now my husband. And we met at the Gloucester Schooner Race. It was great. like all great romances begin. it was, that's
they do.
Another podcast.
They do, the Gloucester Schooner Race.
Yeah, I ended up doing this storytelling event a couple of years ago and ended up telling the story of us meeting at that. That was like what my story was about. And I was like, damn, he was so cute. Like, I just couldn't even stand it. So we came out here and we were going to work on tugboats. That was our goal. That's mm-hmm. what we had said the very first day we met at on the dock in Gloucester, you know, sitting there like chatting over a bag of trash. We were like, hey, you're cute. What are you going to do? And he's like, I'm going to work on tugboats. And I'm like, that's cool. Me too. I'm going to work on tugboats too. You know, and like, and then we're like, let's go work on tugboats together. Oh, but yeah, not like, yeah, we've,
and this is the point where it devolves into like boy talk.
Yeah, it was, but we were, but that was truly our goal. We were like, this is going to work for us. This is how we're going to make our cash money and do the thing. And so, and we like got our license at the same time. You know, we had worked on Tullymore together. We'd worked in Maine together. We were moving as a unit.
Yeah,
we got to Portland, and I started applying, and the tugboats were like, mm-mm, Like, no way, Jose, like, you're not getting in to the tugboat system. Like, it's not happening. And I, you know, I was already coming. At that point, I think I had been working for like six years, maybe. I don't know, but I had my captain's license. So I ended up getting hired to be the captain of a dinner cruise boat that was on the same river system on the Willamette called the Portland Spirit, that was incredibly stressful because it was like 450 people heavily drinking. And like, there was a captain, an engineer, I'll use that term lightly, and one deckhand. And then the rest of the crew was backfilled with the restaurant staff.
Right.
And so it was like, it was great. And I realized then and there, I love motor vessels. Like, I was like, this is awesome. Like, I really enjoy this. I enjoy driving the boat. I enjoy the process of working in this kind of a field. I don't feel like I want to have my license on the line for 450 people that are stumbling around. Like, that feels a little risky. But while I was doing that, I was still continuing to apply. So I was applying, like, me and my friends were exchanging. We had these huge spreadsheets with like every single tugboat company on the West Coast. And I was writing to all them and I was giving them the whole spiel and nobody was biting. And then finally, after a year, and at the same time, I was working at a wood shop in Portland and, you know, kind of trying to keep a balance. But after a year, they finally called me back and they were like, okay. And it was really interesting because they do these cattle call hires for tugboats where they bring a whole group of you in. And then they maybe, you know, will kind of whittle it down and they might hire like eight of you, understanding that they'll probably only keep like one of you, like within a year's time. Like, they're just like, you're going to lose people because it's really, really hard work. It's really hard work. And if I had known then what I know now, I wouldn't have pursued that company.
Right.
Because they did grain barge work and ship assist. And when you start to get into barge work, it's a whole nother ballgame in terms of, I think, the danger. Specifically in inland barge work, in my opinion, I think the reception for anything other than what is on the boats, which is a very particular demographic, we'll say. So I finally got hired and I remember it was like, it was not a warm welcome. They were not happy to have me there. They were not happy to have me on the boat. It was a struggle the entire time I was there in terms of the reception. There was a huge amount of racism. There was a huge amount, I mean, I'm talking like outright blatant on the radio, just full bore racism. Like, you know, this is like getting woken up with captains yelling the N word. Like, you know, we're talking like intense shit. And then HR department, like, really being challenged with me being present, because a lot of the guys, they were like, if you're on this boat, I can't be on this boat because I can't go make money because my wife won't let me be on the boat with you. Or like, now we can't do the things that we like to do, which is watching porn during dinner together. And I'm like, y'all are
first of
crazy.
All, this is really unsanitary, but
yeah, this is like, you know, and the reception in that community was not a warm one. Like, it was, I had to make it through the shop first before I could get through. And like, there was no warm reception. It was incredibly dangerous. Like, one of my hiring, you know, partners, like in my group, lost a finger within like the first couple weeks. I had an accident where I fell off the Texas deck of a boat and hit the dock with my back and like was out, like dislocated my thumb on the cleat. And like, there's a real intense like physicality of the work. Like, you're on grain barges where you have a big leaf blower strapped to your back, and you go out on these barges that are built as you're pushing, you know, up a river to go to a grain elevator, and you're like blowing wet grain off in the wind, because if it gets wet, it sprouts into grass like really quickly and you'll fall off the barge. It's like, just like crazy stuff. And you're like, man, this is awful. Like,
this sucks.
This really sucks. Like, this is really difficult. And it was one of those things where like, I felt an incredible obligation to meet like hardness with hardness. I was like, if you're going to come at me like that, then I'm going to respond in kind, because I need to like establish myself here and make sure that I can produce. And I felt like this incredible obligation to be really successful in the work. And I felt this obligation to impress, you know, and I think that puts us in a dangerous territory, because I was really depending on my physicality to get me through, which means that if there was ever any pressure for me to do things that were maybe a bit more dangerous, I felt like I needed to do it, because I didn't want to be someone that was unwilling to do it the way that you actually do it, you know, because the office tells you like, here's how you get the job done, and you get off the dock and you get up river, and you're building a barge and you're building a tow. And they're like, that's not how you actually do it. You do it this way because it's faster. And you're like, that's how you break your arm. And they're like, what do you, you know? So there was a, you know, you could see that the community ran. And what I found out after getting there was that I counted and I'd worked with, I was working with 16 sons of pilots. So my original motivation for coming there was that this tugboat company was producing all these pilots. But in actuality, it was that all of the sons of the pilots went to work for this company and then got hired as pilots. So it was nepotism at its finest. Like, and it was like crazy because we'd be sailing and we'd, in the middle of the night, you'd go and do like a pilot pickup. And one of the guys would be like, oh, you get to meet dad tonight. And I was like, what? And then their dad would, you know, and like the river pilots are gods. Like,
right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. 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 We worked with the Mississippi River pilots and when we were in New Orleans, and it's a fascinating culture. It's really fascinating.
It's amazing. And you just, you're like, you know, you're just drooling and you're just like, you know, so much about all the things you want to know. And,
yeah. Yeah.
And they would receive me and be like, hey, who's the new guy? Like to me. And I'm like, and they're like, you realize you're going in the water at some point, like everybody does. Just make sure you don't do it between two barges and get killed. Like, you know, and you're like, thank you for the namaste. Thank you, sir. Like, I'll bring you some coffee, you know. And so it was.
So did that, because I know that you're super involved in promoting women in the maritime industry. Like, you're always speaking at Sea Sisters and stuff like that. So is that really where this stem from, that your experience working on the tugs?
Yeah. At the time that I was on the river, there was 4 women total across all the companies on the Columbia River, which is one of the biggest river systems ever. Mm-hmm. Not ever, but it's,
yeah,
it's a large
it's
system.
Big. It's a large system. It's big.
let me get the list out. One of them, want to bring this full circle, one of the other women that worked in the river was the woman I met at the party on the motorcycle that first got me on boats. What?
That's amazing.
Caitlin Stanton. She worked for Foss. There are 2 other women and they were fabulous and there were not enough. Like, there were not enough women, and it was my, whether it be like a very simple interpretation of how to make things better, I was like, well, this is going to continue to be really difficult as long as there is a population that is homogenous.
Right.
And the sooner and more thoroughly we as a community can be about introducing diversity into the commercial industry, the better it's going to be for everyone. The better it's going to be for the crews that are currently on board. It's going to bring diversity of skills, of backgrounds, of abilities, and it's going to create an opening for these incredibly well-paying opportunities to be there for folks that might not otherwise feel like they have access to it. Because it is hard to get in past that first ring sometimes. I mean, there are people that are hiring, but like, I remember they gave me the nickname Stray Cat. That was what they called me because they were like, you just kept hanging around and hanging around and hanging around. And I was like, yeah, I'm just here for the snacks. Like, I like a tugboat meal. Y'all don't skimp on that food budget. Like, you know, but it's like, there is a real opposition. Like when I got hired, I removed my college degree from my resume. I didn't want them to know I had one because I'd been told it would keep them from hiring me. And like, those are the kind of things that I think we really have to try and create space for and open up conversation for. And since I've left that company, I've had a lovely group of guys that I worked with that have actually come and helped in terms of, they come to community panels for the Seafarer Collective and talk about what it is to work on those boats and are willing to share that information really freely. And they've been so generous. Like, I think it really took me like stepping away from it because I wasn't there that long. Like, I worked on the river and then, you know, was going through all of it and got this opportunity to explore a grant for the Seafarer Collective. And I was like, I feel like I need to pursue this. Like, this is an opportunity that's not going to come along. But I did not expect to be, I did not expect to walk away with kind feelings, but I think it really helped. One, that when I fell off the boat, just out of shock, I didn't cry. Like, and that's not because I'm tough. Like, I cry during like Petco commercials, you know, but I was just in shock where I was like, I think I broke my back. And then I was like, somebody get the tater tots. Like, my thumb fell off, you know, like, but because I didn't cry, like, they were like, all right, she's cool. And then when I left, a bunch of them called me afterwards and were like, who wasn't treating you right? Like, well, you know, like, I was like, oh, I don't think we've ever spoken before. Like, it was an interesting.
Who are you again?
it was really interesting because they were like, I think part of that culture is like, you have to stick around long enough and take enough crap, which is not what I encourage as far as healthy workspace to, right. They're like, no, you were doing really well. Like, that was really fun. And I was like, no, it wasn't.
Your definition of fun and my definition of fun are just way different.
Yeah. And it was interesting because at the same time this was happening, my partner got hired the first week that he applied to Tugboats. We had the exact same resumes. Uh-huh. Like, I think I had actually written his resume. Like, we had the exact same resumes, the exact same licenses, all the same experience. He got hired on day one that he applied for another job, and he's been with the same company and loves it. And he's been very successful. He's been hawse piping his way up and like goes and works. That's where he is right now. He's out on an ocean tech, and you're just like, all right, it's a little bit of a different vibration out there. Uh-huh. But he's on ocean tugs too, which is like a whole different bag of worms or something. I don't know.
Right.
so yeah, it was a huge motivation. Like I would love to see, I'd love to walk at a dock. And I've gone and visited them afterwards because they were considering donating a tugboat to the program, which is just crazy. Like, they had this old tugboat and they were like, you want it? And I was like, kind of now, like, let me come look at it. But if I was able to walk to the dock and see folks, you know, from a variety of backgrounds and see, I think, a bit more balance to what that community could be, I think it would be phenomenal. But I think we're probably, you know, it's going to take an active participation on all parts to make that happen.
But there is potential there. And I think that is something to strive for, because there is a lot of opportunity there for people of all backgrounds. And there's a lot of money to be made there. It's, you know, if you like being out on the water and working hard, then maybe start with tall ships. And although it does sound like the complete opposite of the tall ship community going to the tug community. So that must have been quite the shock.
I'm sure there are tugboat communities that are lovely and warm and maybe, I don't know, I haven't seen him. But I mean, and that's not even meant to be like an insult.
Right.
It's just, there was no similarity. I didn't feel like I was even working on the water, to be honest. Like, I was mostly working in engine rooms, which was great. Like, what I learned about engineering and working in the shop was huge. Mm-hmm. Like, so much learning, so much quick learning, so much learning about what happened in the industry, what was going on, like just operating on river systems within like larger sort of maritime communities. So looking at, we had like, there's like Swan Island in Portland. So you've got like these huge car carrier ships that would come in, and then you're doing barge work, and then you're doing tag jobs with like petrol barges, and seeing like this depth of the industry that I had no idea existed. And that is so prevalent and happening underneath everybody's noses. Right. But until you're actually on that boat, you're like, oh, okay. So it was like, super cool, always interesting, never a dull day, but just, you know, couldn't feel less like tall ships in any way. Like, there's no musters, there's no communication, there's no questions, like, you know.
right.
That's not a part of it.
No.
But, you know, if you can hang with it, then you get, you know, you might work half the year, you get month on, month off, you get crazy tugboat benefits, you're in unions that will go to bat, you know, it's like, if you can hang with it, it's worth it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything you want to plug? I know.
So it's, you know, it's actually been a really interesting time coming off of COVID. And then obviously what's been happening on a national and global level with BLM, with the Black Lives Matter movement, because both of those have sort of grazed what I think is a responsibility of everyone within the tall ship community to be addressing really directly, and be addressing in conversation and in support and in programming and in sort of mission and vision. And all these things are coming to the surface right now. So everybody's like super taxed for energy, super taxed for money, sort of confused about where they are, and then having to participate in these really important conversations. And so for me going into that, it was, my hope was that we could really lean into those conversations. I think that there is a huge opportunity moving forward for organizations to be shining a brighter light on their areas of professional development and, I think, diversity, equity, inclusion. But what I've been seeing up to this point is it's a little bit of like splashing around. Like, people are really unsure about how to proceed, how they can use resources in a way that allows them to be sustainable while also dedicating time and space to this. And what I'm seeing is a real disparity between the asks and needs of the mariner, like your individual mariner that serves as like a crew member, and their desire to be focused on these conversations is very high. Mm-hmm. And the ability for organizations, whatever that means or maybe, is difficult and challenging, because oftentimes like you won't even know who that entity is, right? You won't even know who's making those decisions and who's advocating for that. And so moving forward, I think finding ways to create that connection and create space for advocacy will be really important. And my hope is that the Seafarer Collective can help to facilitate some of that in our own, you know, whatever small way that is. But it doesn't work unless there's stability in the nonprofit that we operate under. So if Gray's Harbor has to shut down for the season, so does the Seafarer Collective.
Right.
And so it is tricky and challenging. You're just sort of like waiting and hoping for this sort of like windfall of good luck. So I'm like trying to provide services and support for students that are currently in play. But right now, like I currently as a director am on furlough. Like right. I'm around, you know, so my team can call me, but like my instructors are staying on because they're interacting with students, but I'm in the back waiting to see if like we have the opportunity to come back at this like full bore. When COVID like was ramping up and everything was shutting down, we had to make a very quick decision to be like, okay, we need to batten this up and find the ways to make it as sustainable as possible and as self-running as possible with as few employees as possible. And what that looked like was removing the director, me, right? So
right,
it's like,
right.
So it's hard because I want to lean in and be like, let's dig in and let's do this. But I also don't, like everyone else, don't have a sense of what's to come. Like, and I don't know what that looks like to do this work without organizations running.
I know, it's scary. It's really scary. And these are conversations that we have during every team meeting at Tall Ships America. It's just, you know, you look around and our industry has just been decimated. And, you know, who comes back? How do they come back?
It's really challenging. And it's actually interesting because I was having a conversation with like a Zoom call. It was sort of an informal thing with a group of folks. And it was a lot of young mariners that are chomping at the bit. But in many ways, like that community, this sort of like young, energetic, and not even young, I'm just going to say newer in the industry because I'm not going to identify an age with that, but they are raring to go and have been oftentimes in their careers prior to maritime, very involved in areas of social justice, nonprofit work. Like we tend to attract a very specific demographic with intelligence, just like tugboats, so do tall ships. Like we are not immune to the same level of sort of insular and specific recruiting, and it is oftentimes a liberal arts sort of like it's a type that that is very conversational with what we're doing, but they have been trained to wait for someone I'll say like an officer or a leader to give them sort of like these marching orders. And so I'm seeing a lot of people being like, what are we doing? And there is that need for the higher level of leadership, I think, to have that ability to identify that and then mobilize those folks in a way that can be effective both for the industry and for the social justice, because like you have this, it's like an army of folks that are ready to go. And because it's, everything is so separate in terms of, I think each organization is sort of turtling in on itself, being like, we just have to take care of what's right here, which makes sense. And I can totally understand, but what does that mean for all the mariners that are not inside that turtle, right? Like that means that they're around drifting. They don't have a boat that they identify with. They're not currently affiliated with an organization. They don't have a leader that's telling them how they can participate in a meaningful way. And I think that is going to be another wave of folks that we're going to lose because they're valuable and they're skilled and they've got fire and they don't have a home right now. Like sometimes both figuratively and literally, like they don't have a place to like hang their hat. And that's one of the things that I think is going to be really, really challenging for us in moving forward.
Yeah, I know.
Add it to the pile, I guess. But
yeah,
it's fine.
I know. I know. Maybe I'm trying to think of like, how do we end on a hopeful note?
I know. Maybe they all end up on tugboats and my dream is actualized.
Yeah, maybe. Oh. Maybe this is.
I mean, I was looking like I was this weekend. I was like, man, if I can't keep going with this project, I was like, I might have to go back out. And I was like, who's hiring on tech? And I was like, oh man, that would be a real
kick in the gut. it would, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure it would. Absolutely. But I do appreciate everything that you guys are doing. I really do. I think workforce development is so important, and you guys are really on the forefront of it and teaching us new tricks and, you know, before all this, but I do hope you're able to continue after. I think it's too important not to. It's so, so important for our industry to have people like you pushing for the inclusion and the diversity, and just to get people in the workforce, just to get people in the maritime workforce.
It's like on that, that's like kind of a positive note I can share with you then. I, at some point during this, you know, during this project of the Seafarer Collective, I started, I don't know who gave out my personal address, but my students and folks that I've worked with started sending me these thank you notes where they, and I started putting them up on the fridge, and soon like the whole fridge was covered, and it was like just filled with the most amazing stories, just the craziest stories where people were like, I had no idea this existed. I was, you know, saw an ad here or there, just, you know, fancied it, and now I'm on my way and have been accepted to a maritime academy, or I'm on a research vessel in the North Atlantic, or I'm on the tall ship of my dreams and never going to leave. And I'm like, what are you doing? But you know, like it's crazy. And I was like, these are some classy folks for a handwritten thank you note, first of all. But second of all, I was just like, if like I have to go back to blowing grain with leaf blowers tomorrow and like, you know, fighting with men on the Columbia, like, great. Like that's worth it, because there are that many more folks. There's that many more mariners that have a choice. And like, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, I don't even care if someone doesn't stay in the industry, if it doesn't suit them, but I do want them to have that choice.
Yeah.
Because I remember that was one of the things when I first started sailing, is I was like, I will always be able to find a place to lay my head and fill, you know, get, you know, even if you're paying me in sandwiches, I can be fed, I can have a place to live because of this skill set.
Yeah.
And that can't be taken away. You know, I guess it could be if I was like, you know, just awful, but you know, like, but those, it is an option, you know? And
yeah.
so like when
yeah.
you give people choice, I think you give them one of the best things that you can possibly offer, whether that be the choice of an education that's not maritime, or if it's understanding a credential, or if it's just the choice to pick A or B, you know, like that,
yeah.
that's a really, I think, empowering thing to provide for folks. And if they can do it with understanding that the maritime industry exists, then they're more likely to understand that there are other opportunities and pursue
right.
those. So that has been, I think, one of the things that has kept me centered in this process, is like, okay, I can't control what's happening, you know, fleet-wide or industry-wide or sort of nationwide, but I can control the quality of information that my students are provided and what they are able to pass along, because we don't know how far that ripple goes, right? Like,
right.
And so that's, I think, a positive in all this.
I do too. I think that's a good place to end it. You know, you're just just one person at a time. Well, thank you so, so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
But of course,
this has been very absolutely. Illuminating. It's been fun getting to know you, even though we've known each other for a while.
I know, since the lakes, Erin.
Yeah, apparently.
Remember.
Apparently since 2013.
It's fine.
It's a long summer.
I've lost years of my life from that summer. It's fine. thank you, Erin. Thank you for keeping everybody connected and letting us all get to know each other better through your fine podcasting skills. I don't know what the title is for like a podcast mistress, or I don't know.
Yeah,
like,
we'll leave it at that. Yeah. I think it's host, but I'm not really too sure. I'm not too picky about it.
whatever.
Whatever. We'll go with it.
A Bark, a Brig, and a Schooner Walk Into a Bar is a Tall Ships America production. The music provided by Kebab Studios. You can find us in all the usual places, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Tall Ships America, and on our website at tallshipsamerica.org. Send us your sea stories or drop us a line at manager@tallshipsamerica.org. As always, be sure to support your local tall ship.